The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab number 265 for Wednesday, June 2nd, 2010. Greetings, folks, and welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab. I'm Dave Hamilton here in Durham, New Hampshire. And on the other end is...
John Efron here in Fairfield, Connecticut.
Fantastic. So we have quite a bit of stuff to go through. You know what? Let's just dive right in and let's start with Brad, shall we?
You don't want to talk about the couch?
No, I don't want to talk about the couch.
Or the weather.
Or the weather. That's
all right. But yeah, let's dive right in. This is a great first one because I learned something. I like it when I learn something from
or
from the listeners. Anyways, go ahead.
Brad says, I'm having an issue with my photos in iPhoto 09 in Snow Leopard 10.6. I can see the photos, but when I press the space bar to enlarge the photo, I get the black screen with an exclamation point in the middle of some of them. I may have inadvertently erased some of the pictures, I am assuming. Can I use Time Machine to pull up an old backup, then export pictures to an external hard drive? After that, go back to the most recent backup, delete pictures on the computer, then import again from my external hard drive? Basically, can you go backwards with Time Machine, then upload a newer backup? I know this is not possible with Windows Restore, but wondering if it's different with the Mac. Okay, so the first thing that we should talk about here is that iPhoto stores multiple copies of your pictures. It creates thumbnails. If you make edits to some of your pictures, it stores an original, and then it also stores the edited copy. So by default, yes, you are going to have multiple copies of every picture. And if you do something, either intentionally or not, that goes in and deletes some of those, you'll run into an issue like Brad's seeing here, where you get you sort of see the pictures, but then when you dig deeper, they're not there, or vice versa. Right. So Brad knows what his problem is. John, you found the solution, I believe. Yep. And then this will lead into quite an interesting conversation. So go ahead.
Right. So as you point out, and I found this before also, even if you modify a photo, typically, unless you explicitly delete it, for example, I found this by accident the other day. I was looking through some of my photos and I'll typically tweak them. And I think I accidentally hit the shift key and all of a sudden it changed to the original. And I think that's a shortcut that's not well, I find a lot of things by hitting keys by accident in iPhoto or other apps. But
sure.
Anyway, so as you point out, there's an original buried deep within the, and I think it's the iPhoto library inside of your pictures folders, typically where all this stuff is. Now, what he said he could certainly do, but that's overcomplicating it. There's a nice way to do this, and then you have something even better, Dave. So I had not used this before, but I started going through iPhoto. And if you go to the File menu, there is a Browse Backups option.
This is within iPhoto.
That's correct. So iPhoto in the File menu is, in iPhoto 09 at least, is called Browse Backups. And I'm like, well, let's check that out. When I did Browse Backups, it started up Time Machine, but the interface was almost like it was a hybrid between the Time Machine interface and the iPhoto interface, and that it still was iPhoto with the categories that you would expect on the left, like albums and pictures and all of that stuff. But it also had the feature where you have the time slider on the right. So I don't even think he needs to do what he was proposing, which is to export and re-import. I think he can just, assuming that he was backing up his, he didn't explicitly exclude the iPhoto library from the Time Machine backup, he should just be able to go to whatever category, whether it be pictures or albums or whatever, and just go back in time until it pops up.
Yep, that's right. What I would recommend is go ahead into your pictures folder and make a backup of your iPhoto, like quit iPhoto, make a backup of your iPhoto library folder as it stands. Yes, there's some stuff missing, but just in case this Time Machine Restore overwrites perhaps something newer that you've put in there, it wouldn't be a bad thing because you can always use something like iPhoto Library Manager to merge your old library or your new library with your existing one or whatever needs to happen. So make a backup of that. Just so you've got it somewhere, and that way you're safe. But yeah, I think you're right, John. The the Time Machine integration there in iPhoto should handle this for him. And it's important to note that's what this is. This is not some magic separate iPhoto backup. It is Time Machine, even though it only looks somewhat like Time Machine. Some of Apple's apps support direct Time Machine integration. iPhoto is one, and Mail is another. You get a similar thing. If you navigate to a mailbox in Mail, let's say you go to your inbox, and then Mail, I don't believe Mail has its own Time Machine option in the menus like iPhoto does, but all you got to do is make sure Mail is the frontmost app, and then either hit the Time Machine button if it's still in your dock, or if you've got one in the menu bar and just choose Enter Time Machine, that will do the same thing. It'll bring you to Time Machine, but you're still in the Mail interface and you can restore old copies of your inbox. What will happen, though, is you are overwriting the entire mailbox, I believe. So again, you need to pick which version you want. I don't think it goes down to the message level where you can just extract one message, but it might. Again, you know, having a separate backup just in case so you don't blow something away is highly advisable. But yeah, that Time Machine integration is a very cool thing.
Yeah, and that's the thing I learned today, because I was looking for the menu option, as you said, and there wasn't an explicit one like there is an iPhoto, but as long as it's the frontmost thing and you run Time Machine, it's so very nice. I'll have to dig around and find out what other Apple apps do that sort of thing.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. All right, let's move on to John. John writes, not our John, of course, but listener John writes, hi, guys, I'm having trouble with my late 2007 aluminum iMac for no apparent reason. I'm missing icons in almost every folder. And he sent us a screenshot where there's, you know, maybe 12 folders and five of them have icons. This is in his home folder. But things like documents, downloads, library, movies, pictures, sites, and Dropbox, which is not a Apple folder, are all missing icons. So we wrote him back, and there's a couple of things that could happen here. We do know the answer, and what it was that a cache file had gotten corrupted, and John ran Onyx, and under the cleaning tab, make sure the international preferences box is checked, and that went ahead and cleaned things out. So again, Onyx is a free program that we talk about all the time. You've probably heard about it before, but if you haven't, it's a free piece of software that lets you do all sorts of system maintenance. And in this case, cleaning those caches, which when we say cleaning caches, it deletes the caches and then the system rebuilds them, hopefully rebuilding them from the proper sources. And in John's case, that solved the issue. So that's step one. But the this could be something else. Icons in Mac OS X in the Finder are stored in two ways. One is the default icon for whatever that folder is. And in many cases, right, it's just a default folder icon, not default folder, the app, mind you. Right. But it just a generic folder icon. But you can go in and if you highlight any document or application or folder and go to file and get info, you can see right there. There's an icon in the get info window. And if you click on that, you can either paste in a new icon, you can copy out the existing icon, or if you have already replaced that with a standard icon, you can hit the delete key or choose cut, and that will remove any custom icon and restore it back to its original. So in John's case, that's not what happened. But if you do have some corrupted icon in there and you just want to go back to the default, you can do it that way by highlighting the icon in the get info window and choosing delete. Does that get too convoluted, John?
No, I'm with you on that. Yeah, so it was a corrupted cache. And as you pointed out, there's a way to examine or change the icons if you want to do that sort of thing.
Right. Let's talk about our first sponsor, which is Smile on My Mac with Disk Label. Disk Label is one of those apps that when you need it, it's exactly the right app for you. Recently, one of the bands that I was in, we put together a quick little demo, and the guy that was kind of handling everything said, all right, now I need to burn these to CD, which of course, you know, most of us can do with our computers these days. He said, but does anybody have, you know, some software or something where I can print those labels that'll stick on the CD? I want to kind of put our band logo on them and that sort of thing. And instantly it was like, oh, dude, you need disc label. And so I, you know, I sent him off to the website and he's like, oh, that's exactly what I need. And it is, you know, there are times when you want to create either a label to stick on the CD or a jewel case insert or a DVD case insert or all three. And disc label is the perfect app to do this with. It comes with templates perfectly built to match the CD or DVD. And you can then put your own artwork in. You can use their templates to give you a starting point. You can use their templates to give you a finishing point if you want. And it really makes this easy. Of course, like everything else that we get from Smile on My Mac, there is a free trial available. So you can go and check it out and make sure it's going to work for you. And then after that, it's $36, $35.95 US. They do have a 90-day money-back guarantee. So chances are after 90 days, you know, after you purchase it, you're going to love this thing so much, not even going to think about that. But they are so confident that you're going to love it that they'll offer you a 90-day money-back guarantee. It is, of course, compatible with Snow Leopard. And, like I said, it's exactly what when you want it, it's exactly what you want. So this is Disc Label. You're doing, you know, your summer trips and you get all your pictures from your vacation. And you want to put them on a DVD. You make your DVD with iMovie or iDVD. And then, you know, you slap a label on it. You put it in a jewel case and bam, you can hand it out to family and friends or store one in your own archives. And when you go and grab it, it looks nice. You've got a picture on the front that you customized. Maybe one of the pictures from your trip. You put some text on there. You're good to go. SmileOnMyMac.com/disclabel, DISCLABEL. All right. Moving on to Nicole, John. All right. Nicole writes, I've got a situation that has stumped me for about 6 months now. I purchased my first MacBook Pro in 2009, so it's just 6 months old. Straight out of the box, I've had trackpad issues. I visited the Genius Bar 3 times, and of course, they can never reproduce it. They've offered to replace the trackpad, which I was reluctant to do initially, but after a few more months of frustration, I agreed. They turned it around in a day, didn't break anything else where they were in there, and touchpad behavior is unchanged. Since then, I've raised the issue with the creatives at the Apple Store during the course of my one-to-one sessions. They have nothing to say. AppleCare didn't offer any help either, though I can't remember what they actually said when I talked to them. It's been a while. Can't say I blame anyone at Apple for not getting it, because the dang thing never acts up in their presence. The issue is this. When attempting to use one-finger action on the trackpad, like moving the pointer will actually freeze on the screen for anywhere from 2 to 8 seconds. It doesn't seem isolated to any particular apps. Happens anywhere, anytime. I really do believe I've ruled out user error. For starters, I become incredibly deliberate about how I use the trackpad. I very carefully take my pointer finger and ball up the rest of my fingers in a fist. Then I remove my other hand from the surface completely, so I don't think that the trackpad is picking up confusing signals. This is super frustrating. Even though it's only a few seconds lost here and there, it is agonizing. I've played with trackpad settings, and I haven't seen any changes. Do you have any suggestions? Okay. Yes, I think, John, you and I both have suggestions on this. Well, yeah, I've been gabbering. That's a new verb, right? I've been gabbering a lot. Take it. Go.
Okay. And actually, I came up with one while you were gabbering. I actually came up with one that just popped into my head here, that we have a number of them.
Okay.
So here's one suggestion. All right. Nicole pointed out that this does not happen, which, you know, is always the case. It never happens when you show it to support people.
Right.
The problem goes away. But what occurred to me, so the thing is, the trackpad is actually a USB device. Because if you look in System Profiler and you look under USB, you will see a device. It's called, surprise, Apple Internal Keyboard / Trackpad. I'm going to suggest one thing, and you can probably already guess what it is, Dave. Does she have any other USB devices plugged into the computer that could be potentially freaking out the USB bus?
Right.
Because my assumption is when she brings the machine in, she's not bringing in all of the peripherals that she has hooked up. So, one suggestion, disconnect all of your peripherals and see if the problem goes away. It's a long shot, but I think it's a reasonable assumption, a reasonable thing to try.
Sure. Okay. So yeah, that definitely, you know, it's a laptop. So maybe she doesn't have any USB peripherals, but in either case, yeah, agreed. You know, try and replicate the environment where you've seen it work as well as you can when it's in a situation where it's not working. And if that means it wasn't plugged into anything at the Apple store, then it means it's, you know, don't plug it into anything at home and try it that way. But that also means replicate the environment. The trackpad is a static device, I believe. It runs on electrostatic, right? Something like that, John? And
I thought it was capacitive.
Capacitive, thank you. That's the word I was looking for. My gabbering wasn't getting me there. It is a capacitive device, which means that it requires some sort of signal from your hand. And if your hand or the air is either very dry or perhaps very wet, the trackpad will not respond. So if the humidity in your house is radically different from that at the Apple store, I'm assuming that it works for you, Nicole, at the Apple store and not at home. If it doesn't work for you at the Apple store, but it works for everybody else, then the environmental issue is a far more closer to home, as it were. And it could be your hands themselves are simply not within spec, if you would, right, to work with a trackpad. But assuming that's not the case, then I would take a look at the environment at home. Perhaps it's very, very dry there. If that's the case, the trackpad won't work. If it's very, very humid, it also won't work. It's looking for a delta, I think, right? That in order for the trackpad to sense motion, it needs to see more moisture in the spot where you're touching than the other spots. Is that right, John?
I found an article that we can link to here, but it is a technology overview. And what they say in short here is that technology overview of the trackpad works on a principle called coupling capacitance. As your finger moves over the surface, the trackpad evaluates the change of capacitance between two layers of measurement electrodes built into the surface of the trackpad. Blah, blah, blah.
Okay.
But what you're saying is, and I've noticed this too, actually. I've noticed this when I've either, if my fingers are wet.
Yeah, try using your trackpad when you get out of the shower, like in a hotel room. I've done that. You know, you try and go check your email right after you're out of the shower. It never works. Never.
It doesn't work great because I think the capacitance, or it can't, because of the moisture, it can't detect the capacitance. So I'm with you. Is the an environmental factor maybe impacting the ability of the trackpad to do what it does?
Yep. It's got to be. I mean, it doesn't have to be. Like you said, it could be a USB device issue or driver issue. It could also be that you got two bad trackpads. Very rare, but certainly possible in the grand scheme of things. Apple has made more than one bad trackpad, and perhaps you got two of them, right? But if they're not able to reproduce it at the store, and more importantly, if you're not able to reproduce it at the store, then, yeah, you know, maybe it's time to get a humidifier for the house or a dehumidifier, right? I mean, there are other reasons besides just your trackpad to worry about the humidity at home, right? Health reasons and all of that good stuff.
Right. So because the interference, I think she touched upon this, that there is the potential if you got too much stuff happening on the trackpad that it may get confused. But that used to be an explicit setting in the trackpad, but that's built in right now. You don't even get the box anymore where you could say, you know, ignore extraneous input. But I'm pretty sure this machine is new enough where that's built in, because one day I'd look to try to find this setting in the trackpad and it's not there anymore. And I looked why, and Apple said, well, it's built into the behavior. Now, the other thing, you could go to the console. Another thing I'm suspecting, because, you know, I love pointing out hardware problems. I've noticed this message sometimes in the console. And the message is as follows. Apple USB multi-touch driver, :, validate checksum. Packet checksum incorrect. Expected whatever checksum bytes were whatever. What that's saying is, so a checksum is a very basic integrity check, where you basically just add up all the numbers in something, and that's a checksum. There are more sophisticated ways of going about this, but it's a very basic way of error correction. And the problem is, if the formula, what happens is that if when the data comes from one side to the other, if the checks, it recalculates the checksum, and if it's different, then the assumption is that the data somehow got corrupted. So it could potentially be a flaky a different USB problem, but it could be a flaky connection from the trackpad to the motherboard, because I've actually seen this, at least, you know, when I had to, you know, the number of times I've been in my machine, there's a cable that goes from the trackpad to the motherboard. If that's loose or wasn't replaced properly, then potentially. So look in your console, and if you see any of these Apple USB multi-touch driver checksum errors, it's a bad or flaky connection between the trackpad and the motherboard, and they should get in there and fix it. Or the trackpad is starting to freak out, as you suggested.
Sure.
It could be another bad one. So sure. Just another tool for you to try to identify if it's maybe the hardware that's faulty.
All right. Let's move on to Will. Will writes, I have a Mac Pro 2007 Intel quad-core 3 gigahertz machine. I recently added a third Seagate Barracuda drive, same as the model I have in my second bay. I went to start it up after installing the new drive, and the graphics card fan started spinning at full throttle, and the drives did nothing. Perhaps it was the new drive, I thought. So I held down the power button until the machine turned off, disconnected all the cables, and removed the third new drive. I plugged everything back in and booted the machine. Same thing. So I thought maybe I burned out my video card. I happened to have a spare that had come with the machine originally and then swapped it out. Same thing. Just a nice loud fan, which is great on a hot day, but a very expensive alternative to a conventional fan. Now I'm sitting here with a Turbo Blower Mac Pro that does squat. My question is, do you think my logic board is fried? And could installing a new drive actually do this? If it is the logic board, how hard is it to install a new one? Before you ask, yes, I have, or should I say I had AppleCare and it ran out last month. I found a logic board from DV Warehouse, but I cannot find any how-to videos online, so I'm not sure if it's something I have the right tools for. I'm pretty savvy with teardowns and getting under the hood, but I've never had to take on a logic board before. Okay. John, my feeling on this is that it's certainly possible, and in fact likely, that it was a motherboard that was shorted out. I mean, he's swapped out the graphics card, but you know, it even if it was the graphics card, the drives would still spin up. You'd still hear sound. You'd still get some other reaction out of the machine, even if you couldn't actually see anything. It would sound like it was booting or doing something. You know, again, going back to humidity and dust and static and all of that, it's certainly possible when you're in there. And I did this once. I had a Mac 2CI when I worked at Citibank. First computer that I was ever paid to update on that job. And I burned out the motherboard. I went in to put some new card in. Maybe I was putting RAM in or something. And, you know, I just opened it up like I'd done with other machines for myself and friends and that thing before. And popped it open, put the RAM in, closed it up. Nothing. Okay. You know, took the RAM out. Still nothing. Not good. Called up Apple. They're like, oh, yeah. We'll send somebody out. And they did. And sure enough, it was, you know, bad motherboard. Thankfully, that was covered by either our support contract or AppleCare or whatever it was at the time. But, you know, it's definitely possible, you know, as you're moving things around, dust can skate across the board, cause static, and boom, you're out of luck. So, yes, I do think it's possible that it's a motherboard. John, before we talk about replacing the motherboard and what that entails, why don't you share your thoughts on this?
Okay, so a few nuggets I'm going to offer here. So, number one, so it sounds like it's Will, right?
Yep.
It sounds like he's comfortable getting inside a machine here. The first thing I'm going to offer here is going to sound fairly obvious, but we don't want to assume that everybody knows this here. So number one, and I'm sure he did this, but again, if you're ever going to get in the machine, number one, turn it off. Okay. I'm not being condescending. I'm just saying, nope. You know, sometimes.
All right, I gotta jump in here and tell a story not being condescending and I would never purport to be condescending, especially about this. Back when I was doing, and then I'll let you get your thing, but this tangent's funny. Back when I was doing a lot of consulting and we had our computer nerds business down in Texas, I'm sitting with a client and we were putting a new modem in, a US Robotics Sportster, right? It was going inside his machine. And it's a Windows machine. It was fun. You know, we did a lot of Windows work. And so the first thing I would do is boot the machine up, make sure that, you know, the device manager, this was in the Windows 95, maybe the 98 days, but it was after plug and play had come out, but it wasn't entirely reliable, you know. And so went through the deal and looked in the device manager. Everything's good. Okay, great. So, you know, I get the modem out, and I go around, and I had to get at the computer kind of from behind the desk. So he's sitting there in the chair that was, you know, next to me, and I got up out of the chair and went around to the back of the computer, opened it up, put the new modem in, and I hear the client say, "New hardware found." And that's when it hit me. I had never turned the computer off. Now, somehow, the stars had aligned in my favor, and I put this board in just right. And somehow, it didn't fry the machine, and the machine was just happy. Oh, yep, new hardware, no problem. And so, I'm sitting there, you know, my first instinct was to scream, and thankfully, I held that back, and I said, oh, great. Excellent. So I came back around. I made sure the drivers were installed. I'm like, all right, we're good. Yep, that's excellent. And, you know, we went on our merry way. But, yes, yep. It happens. Mm. So don't assume it's off, even if you've turned a computer off hundreds or thousands of times before. So right. Back to you, John.
Now, the second thing I'm going to suggest is I'm going to give you my feelings on this. But if I'm working on something, even though it's off, I will leave the power cord plugged in. Okay. The reason I do that is because that makes sure that the machine, assuming that you're on a grounded outlet, which you really should be, is that the machine and the case and all that is grounded. So in the event that, and I'm going to tie this to something else. So some, the thing is, some machines, like even I think this G5 that I have here, even if it's off, there's a little trickle of power powering some of the stuff inside the machine, but I don't think it's anything I'm still going to suggest that. I'm going to stand behind that because I've always done that when I've worked on a machine. Even though it's off, I leave the power cord plugged in and plugged into the wall.
Does that include when you're putting RAM in a machine?
Yes.
Okay. A laptop, laptops too, or just desktops?
Just desktops.
Okay.
Actually, a laptop? No, laptop, I will do something different. So maybe I'm being contradicting myself. Yeah. No, a laptop, and I think it's the recommendation of that, but for a laptop, I think you want to take the battery out and also leave it.
See what I'm getting at here?
No, that's a good one. So I'm thinking desktops, though I believe when I've done it on laptops, I've had it both disconnected from, I believe that's the recommendation. We should look into that.
Yeah.
No, you bring up a good point.
So
I'm contradicting myself because desktops, when I've worked on them, even replacing RAM or any components, I always leave it plugged in because it provides that ground. Along with that, what you may want to get, and you should be able to get this at almost any Radio Shack or something like that, get what's called a grounding strap.
Right.
And this is basically a little strap that you put around your wrist if you've worked in a technical or, you know, you work in a lab or something like that. I mean, I know the lab people that I've worked with on a bench when they're soldering and all that sort of thing here. So one of it is a little strip that wraps around your wrist. Some of them are throwaways and some of them are single use. Or you can use them again. So one of it you usually typically put around your wrist, and then the other thing will be a clip that you typically clip to something. Usually a ground, like maybe the frame of the machine that you're working on. What that does is just, you know, if there's any energy building up on you, it's going to kind of shuffle into the ground strap and into the wire and through the case and into ground, and everything's going to be great rather than the charge building up on you and then you zapping something. So, I got to ponder that. No, you bring up a good point there because I do follow a different procedure when I'm working on a laptop than when I'm working on desktop. That's a good one. How about you?
Well, yeah, I do exactly the same thing that you do. So, and it's because I like that ground. The difference is on the laptop, the ground is separate from, in my opinion, the ground is, you know, not coming through that little DC cable that's trickling power to the laptop, right? So it's not getting grounded regardless of whether or not it's plugged in. Whereas a desktop, you know, the power supply is internal to the machine and presumably grounded to the chassis. So there is the benefit of ground. So but I do exactly the same thing you do, is I leave it plugged in. If it's a desktop, if it's a laptop, I remove all traces of power because, you know, that thing's bound to start up on you. And the same is true of a desktop, right? You know, if you hit the power button while you're in there, hands off, right? Get out.
Okay.
Yeah. So
I'd be curious to know from any of our listeners who either, you know, work at Apple or do other technical work, what processes they follow and how it differs between a desktop machine and a laptop machine.
I never used a grounding strap. I um, I always just grabbed the power supply when I was inside the computer, and you know what I would do is I'd get my feet stable, and then I'd grab the power supply, and then I would make sure not to shuffle my feet or do anything like that that would, you know, build up any noticeable charge at that point. And there were many times where I grabbed a power supply and felt a shock and was like, okay, well, at least I discharged myself there as opposed to on the motherboard or video card or whatever else inside the machine. So,
yeah. And the worst time usually for this to happen is usually in the winter, at least my experience in the Northeast, right. Because a lot of, you've run into this. I mean, you walk around and you'll touch, you know, doorknobs and other people and you'll shock them with static electricity.
Right.
So maybe you want to make sure that the area you're in, has a certain amount of humidity to prevent that sort of thing happening.
Right.
I'm going to wrap up with something else, which may be the case. I kind of doubt it, but I'll toss it out anyways.
Yep.
You may want to try resetting either the SMC, which is the system management controller. That handles some power functions. So it could be that that's why the fans are spinning up and nothing's happening.
Yeah.
And we'll link to an article on how to do that. It varies on the machine. Or try to reset the PRAM.
Right.
Again, something in these, you know, portions of the Mac memory may have gotten corrupted, and that's why it's not starting up right. I kind of doubt it. I think the motherboard's been zapped, but it's worth a try.
It's always worth a try. That's right. Yep. Yep. Okay. Let's move on to where are we doing on time here? Where are we here? Let's move on to Justin. Let's do this.
Hi, John and Dave. It's Justin from the UK. I have a problem with a Xerox 8560 multifunctional printer. My problem is this, that the scanning function just does not want to work, and I'm not sure if Xerox actually support it on Snow Leopard. They've released their updated drivers about 6 months ago or so, but it still doesn't want to work. I'm not sure if I need to set it up with a network connection. I'm not really sure about how to do this anyway. Just wonder if you could help me out or suggest a solution. It's really annoying because it was quite an expensive multifunctional printer, and Xerox say it's fully compatible, but it just does not want to work off a USB. So love the podcast, love the show. This is the part you cut me off.
All right. A nice reverb there. I'm not sure if that was artificial reverb or if you were in a gymnasium.
But I just noticed that. I didn't hear it on the laptop, but I certainly heard it with my headphones. So I could, if I heard him, he said 856D.
Correct. Right? Yeah.
Okay. I searched and I could not. I don't know if that's I'm going to guess he's across the pond there. So I don't know if this is He might have.
He probably meant the 865D, which is, but it's irrelevant. Okay, the reality is, and your experience.
I found
is,
it. You're right.
Yeah, your experience is going to vary depending on the model of printer and the operating system. Right. I have a HP LaserJet 3055 multifunction printer, network and USB capable. Great printer. It copies, it faxes, it's got its own, you know, phone port in it. It can fax from the computer via the computer. And then of course it scans, except with 10.6.3. Worked fine. The officially when Leopard came out, I got, you know, this printer's older, but certainly as far as the printer's concerned, a fine printer still. When Leopard came out, it took 6 months for them to come out with Leopard drivers. Finally, they came out with Leopard drivers. You know, there was a way to get it working, but you had to hold your mouth just right. The Leopard drivers have worked just fine with Snow Leopard up until 10.6.3. Snow Leopard still sees the printer. It will still print to it, no problem. But when you go to scan, it sees it as a scanner, but it will not scan from it. And I've tried it on multiple machines. The Apple changed something in 10.6.3. And to be fair, they changed a lot in 10.6 that it can interfere with the way certain scanners and certain drivers work. It really depends on the printer itself. The best thing you can do is remove all the printer software for that printer from your computer and then start from scratch. Sometimes that will get it to work in Snow Leopard, but again, it's going to be on a case by case basis. And unfortunately, the answer is if it doesn't work until the manufacturer comes out A, acknowledges that it doesn't work, and then B, comes out with a revised driver. Or Apple maybe 10.6.4 fixes what they broke in 10.6.3. Who knows? So that's my experience with it. Now, John, you bought a newer multifunction printer, and you had a much different experience, as one would expect.
Right. So one thing I'm going to suggest, or one thing I'm going to point out here. So so I looked on. Let me get his question up here. So 865. Who are we talking about here?
Justin. It's not an email question. It's just an audio question. So there's nothing to read.
Ah. Okay. And he was saying 10.6.
He's in Snow Leopard.
Oh, he is. Okay. Yep. That's what I thought I heard. Okay. Yep. So in Snow Leopard. Now, what you can do is go to System Preferences. Go to Print and Fax, and you should have the printer on the left. What you can do, I'm going to offer one suggestion here. So, of course, if you double click on it, it should bring up, utility, and you should be able to click on then printer setup, and then there will be a driver tab. Now, one thing that you could do here, or something I'm going to point out here, so if you then go to the driver tab and then select, the choice is select printer software, that'll give you a list of all of the drivers that are built in or have been installed on the OS. Now, what you notice is some of them will say, at least under Snow Leopard, Cups and Gutenprint. What that is an open source driver effort. Some will not have that. If they don't have that, then my understanding is that that's a driver that's been provided by the manufacturer.
Okay. Important to note, though, you're talking about printer drivers there. That does not show you scanner drivers.
Yes.
So.
Okay. But I think they could... yes, you're correct. Okay, so what I'm suggesting is that if you look at this list here, you may be getting a driver that will offer you both. Well, one thing he could try, I'll tell you why I say that, because, as you pointed out, so I recently got my mom a new multifunction device, an HP device. What I noticed with that, so first off, HP is pretty well supported under Mac OS X, and this was a pretty much current model here. But what happened is basically plugged it in, went to the printer utility to add a printer, and it actually, what I see happen a lot of times is when you install a new printer, Snow Leopard will go out to Apple and say, hey, are there any new drivers for what I think is connected to me? And in this case, it actually downloaded both a printer driver, but then it also installed a scanner driver. And how do I know this? Because when I went to I was looking at a picture in preview, and I'm almost positive it was preview, but I was looking at a picture in preview, and I noticed in the upper right corner of preview, it said image scan or scan. A preview is an application that if you do have a scanner, if I'm remembering this correctly, I don't have the screenshot in front of me.
Yep.
But we'll let you, if you are connected to an image scanner, we'll recognize that fact. And I think it launches if you're image connected, capture.
Yeah, if you're connected to an image capture capable scanner. Some scanners only work with software from the manufacturer. Some, it depends. Right.
Correct.
So, yeah. But yeah, if there's an Apple blessed or proper, I don't want to say properly written, but maybe that's the right term, a properly written driver, then yes, it can show up in image capture. Absolutely. Yeah. The problem with that is, some printers, like my printer has, or my scanner has a document feeder, and then it's also got the glass. So, I'm not sure what the capabilities of image capture are, if it can handle that sort of thing. And that may be why some vendors say, I'm not going to mess with trying to, shoehorn my printer's capabilities into the form that image capture wants to see. I'm just going to go ahead and write my own driver.
Well, I think what it has to be, what is it?
Is it Twain?
It's coming to me. Yes. Oh, wow. We're in sync today. Yes. Typically, yeah, I've run into this because I was using, it was an Epson Perfection M750, I think.
Okay.
In the workplace. And that's a pretty nice, actually, I think it's like a 6400 DPI scanner. It's really sweet. But when I plugged that into the Mac Mini, image capture would see it. My understanding is that image capture will typically see things that have, as you point out, a Twain driver. Twain is a standard for, so actually, here's another suggestion.
Do you know what Twain stands for?
Oh, it's one of these kind of wise guy.
It is. It doesn't stand for anything. Some people say that it stands for technology without an interesting name.
Yes.
but with the word Twain, according if Wikipedia is to be believed, which of course it's not, is from the Ballad of East and West by Rudyard Kipling, where he says, "And never the twain shall meet." And of course, mm-hmm. Twain being the standard that allows one driver to work with another, it's that middle ground. So that's kind of where that name came from. So, but yeah. Right.
So, fire up image capture, see if it shows up at the devices, or reach out to the Xerox and see if they have a Twain compatible driver, in which case then he should be able to get to the image scanning functionality.
Yeah, if Xerox says that their drivers are certified to work not just with Snow Leopard, but with 10.6.3, because we have definitely noticed that there is some change that happened in 10.6.3. But if Xerox says that they are, known to work with 10.6.3, then go through that process, uninstall everything, then go to the system preferences, printers and facts, like John mentioned, and remove all traces of that printer from there, reboot the machine, and then install fresh from the latest download you can get from Xerox. And that may solve the problem. That it's not unforeseeable to think that would, get past whatever all this is. So,
yeah, I'm not getting a warm fuzzy here because I just found this on the Xerox site.
Okay.
And the only OS that I see is a supported OS for this device. Or at least where they offer.
Yeah.
No. I'm sorry. I see Windows Vista for the XC865.
Yeah.
Then I see a little box here saying Windows 7 and Mac OS 10.6. Updated drivers and support now available.
Well.
Right? I found this on the Xerox site. So it may just be a matter of... So it sounds like it didn't grab the right thing when he installed it. The OS 10 capability did not... It sounds like it did not grab the right thing. Sometimes you have to explicitly download the driver from the vendor.
Yeah.
Because sometimes they'll provide it to Apple and Apple and it'll pull it off Apple servers. But in some cases, you may have to go to the vendor itself. But as far as I can tell here, well, it says for a list of Xerox equipment compatible with macOS 10.6. I'm going to click on this. Maybe you can vamp a little bit here, but let's... 865 was it or 856?
Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, the reality is he's got to get with Xerox and figure out whether it's supposed to work with 10.6.3, because otherwise he's chasing his tail. Right, 10.6 okay. Support is not enough to know, but it's worth chasing your tail. That one, remove everything, only install from Xerox, and then once it gets working. If software update offers to update your printer driver to whatever Apple wants to put on there, say no. Do not do that, right? Once it's working, don't let those drivers that are going to come through software update overwrite them. So,
okay. And actually, I see in the Xerox support document, they have different levels of compatibility for the devices.
Yeah.
And it ranges. So this kind of backs up what I said before. So it ranges from, so their top level of support says drivers for Mac OS 10.6 are available through Apple software update service and can also be downloaded from Xerox.com, which indicates to me that they're the same driver.
Should be.
Both from Apple and Xerox, and the drivers are fully compatible with 32 and 64-bit. And then the support starts to degrade. Then they have some cases where it says, well, you got to download it from us. So
right. All right. Our second sponsor for this show is Circus Ponies at CircusPonies.com with Notebook. Now, Notebook is an app that allows you to organize your thoughts over specific topics or events or classes or whatever. If you're a student or perhaps you are in the workforce, but you have to go take a class, Notebook is going to be a great asset for this. What you do is you start a new notebook for whatever class it is. And the first thing you'll see is what resembles a white line notebook. In fact, this would be a great thing to use at WWDC next week if you're going, right? You start taking notes. You can use Tab to get things hierarchical. Then if you, let's say you, at the end of the presentation, I was reading today on TMO, John Martellaro said, stick around at the end and very quickly either jot down or snap a picture of all the contact information that the Apple engineers provide. This can be a great way to get, to maintain a relationship with these people beyond WWDC and get some questions answered. So his advice was snap that picture. Well, you could snap that picture and then drag that picture in to your notebook and pull it right in. You can annotate it from there. You get home from WWDC. Now you've got a different, let's say, you know, you could create a different notebook for each session that you took, or you could create different notebooks for each track, right? Maybe one is all iPhone stuff. Maybe one is WebKit stuff, et cetera, et cetera. Now you've got all this stuff. You can search within the notebook and you can say, gosh, you know, I know there was an iPhone session I was at on Tuesday where they talked about, you know, some class that I really want to research, but I can't remember. Well, you search by date and you say, find me everything that I edited on Tuesday, and boom, it'll come up right there. And then, you know, you can tag it or annotate it any way you like. This is all available at circusponies.com. Notebook is, of course, available for a free download. It's a 30-day trial, so that'll get you through WWDC. Once you love it, though, you go and buy it. $49.95 is the standard license. If you are a student going to college or anything below that, I guess, $29.95 is the academic license. And, of course, you can get a three-user license as a family pack for $99.95. All available at circusponies.com, but go ahead and grab the free download first. Check it out. And once you love it, then go and buy it. And they'll appreciate that. And I think you'll appreciate it too. Circusponies.com. I said that already. All right. Let's hear what Adrian has to say. This gets interesting.
Hey, John and Dave. This is Adrian from Pennsylvania. And I'm having a problem. It's on my wife's iMac. It's sort of sporadic. I'll go, you know, she'll try to send an email and she'll get the message, cannot send message using the server smtp.me.com:, her username. And I've tried deleting the account and re-adding it. I've tried editing the ports, choosing only 587 or only 25. I can't really figure it out. Any help would be appreciated. This is where you cut me off.
So we will cut you off. All right. So a couple of things could be happening here, right? It could simply be that you are trying to send mail when MobileMe's servers are down. I haven't heard about that happening nearly as much lately as it used to. But certainly if their servers are down, you ain't no mail getting through. Right. And they do have them. There are multiple servers around. They're location based. So it's possible that the one that you normally pick is more problematic than others. But let's rule that out. Let's assume for the sake of discussion that that's not it. Right. It could be that, you know, mail is interesting in the way it configures things. If you go into preferences, accounts, and then at the bottom, you'll see outgoing mail SMTP. Click on the server there and choose edit SMTP server list, I think, or edit outgoing list. I can't remember. Edit SMTP server list. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then click on your MobileMe server, which will probably be smtp.me.com, and click advanced. You'll see chances are it says use default ports 25, 465, 587. It's important to know what each of these ports is for. 25 is the standard, venerable mail port that all mail on the internet, at least outbound mail, is trafficked upon, right? A lot of ISPs will block you from connecting outside of their network on port 25. And the reason for this is, there was a lot of Windows-based spam back in the day. There might still be that would generate junk mail and send out spam or be a spam relay. And right. And so they block port 25 from getting outside their networks just to limit this. So using port 25 is a bad idea anyway.
And it's usually insecure.
And it's usually insecure.
It's in the clear.
Right. So. Now, if you want to stay in the clear, and that's what port 587 was created for. It's essentially it's supposed to act the same way that port 25 does, but is not for server to server communication. It's for end user outbound communication. So that's what 587 is for. Again, still built to be in the clear. But that's what 587 is for, is the 25 alternative. And most ISPs won't block 587 because they know that if you're talking to a server on 587, you're not trying to pretend that you're some other mail server sending the mail. 465, though, is your best bet as long as the server supports it, because that's the port that SSL or secure mail is trafficked on. So my advice is do two things here. One, set the use custom port in mail and type in 465. That way we're not leaving it up to mail to try and pick, you know, maybe whatever's happening to your wife's computer, Adrian, is that for whatever reason, it's defaulting back to port 25 at sometimes, and then your ISP blocks it and you're horked, right? So use a custom port 465, check the box that says use secure sockets layer, and hopefully at that point you're done and the problem will go away, because at least you've narrowed down any variable on what port it's going to choose or how it's going to try and send that mail. That's my advice.
I'm with you on that. And actually you showed me that setting. I had never seen that before.
Yeah.
So I was like, well, no, I'm using port 25 to MobileMe. And the thing is, I don't know if I am. I'll have to actually dig and see if I am. But yeah, I had the button checked that you pointed out, and I also had SSL checked. So I'm almost certain it's not using port 25. But one thing I want to mention, you could determine if your ISP or somebody's blocking it by doing this. And this is a good little trick for just testing out any connection here. So what you want to try to do, go to the terminal and use our friend Telnet. Now, you're going to be using Telnet in a different way here. So Telnet is typically used to, it's an insecure way of connecting to another computer with a text interface over a network. The thing is that if you're doing it from the command line, you don't necessarily have to default to the Telnet port.
Right.
Which I forgot off the top of my head which it is. Maybe you remember. Don't worry about it.
43? Okay. No.
Anyways, don't worry about it. It doesn't matter.
Know this. But go ahead. Yeah, it doesn't matter. You're right. Right.
Or 22, I thought it was.
No, that's SSH.
Okay. Which is, yes. What you can do is go to the terminal and then type telnet space the name of the server or computer you want to go to, which in this case would be smtp.me.com. Then another space, and then the port that you want to connect to. So if you don't put anything there, it's going to try to do it on the telnet port.
Which is 23.
23. Okay, very close. But say I wanted to connect to port 25, then what I would do is after the name of the server, a space, and then 25.
That's right. So the command, just to tie it all together, is telnet. No E in the middle between the L and the N. It's not telnet. It is telnet. T-E-L-N-E-T space smtp.me.com space 25.
Now, if that's blocked, then you'll probably get a message like connection refused or something like that, indicating somebody along the way is blocking it. If you type that and then you bang on some keys and you get something, you get a response or something.
Well, what it should say is trying, and then it'll give you an IP address. And if you get connected, it'll say connected to smtb.me.com, an escape characters control bracket. And then it'll give you the server's response, which should say something about Mac.com in it. What's also possible is that a lot of ISPs will, and not so much ISPs, but like hotel rooms and those kind of networks will trap traffic on port 25. So any traffic that you're trying to send out on 25, they'll route to their own mail server, not to be, not to be nefarious or anything, but to make your life easier and send mail through a server that they know is going to accept your mail. So if you don't see something about Mac.com in there, then you know that something is trapping it. And that could also be the issue.
Yeah. And actually, I just checked mine here. So as you point out, so what's going to happen after a while, and I just saw this because I guess it waits for a while.
Yep.
I got a message here, connect address, and it gives the IP address. And it says operation timed out, and then it says unable to connect to remote host. So as far as I can tell here, my ISP doesn't want me to connect to 25.
Interesting. I used to have 25 blocked from me here, and I just tried it now, and it let me through just fine. So go figure. But that's it, right? Sometimes they're going to block it, sometimes not. It's not a bad thing if your ISP blocks port 25. Don't fault them for that. Do we have anything else on this? Or are we?
No, I think we're cool.
Okay. So, yeah, but that would be a good thing. You know, try 25. If 25 is blocked, try 465 and then try 587. And once you figure out which one it answers on, hopefully it answers on 465 and you can just be done with it. You put that in, you save your changes there in mail, and then you don't have to worry because, you know, 25 is going to be blocked or not blocked by, you know, depending on where your connection is. 465 is never going to be blocked, or at least it shouldn't be. So if you take your machine and you go somewhere else, or you're in a hotel, or you bring it to a, you know, friend's house or whatever, it's just going to work. So, all right, we've got time for a couple more. Interestingly enough, you know, those connection issues that I've been having, Comcast has been working on them. And the Comcast tech is actually sitting outside waiting for us to finish the show so they can run a new line. I'm not convinced that that the line's the issue.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. But they want to run a new line. And so I'm just going to go ahead and let them. I'm not going to complain. So, okay. You know, my wife told them, oh, you got to wait. My husband's podcasting. They've been out there for 45 minutes. So, they could have called and set up an appointment. Right. I had no idea when they were coming. I certainly didn't expect them today. There was not. So, you know,
well, it's just like payback. I mean, how many times have you waited for the cable person?
I feel no remorse. You might not notice it from my voice, but I feel no remorse about this.
Yeah. Well, Katie, I think Katie's a quick one.
Yeah, let's do that. You had a conversation, I guess it was on Twitter or maybe via email with Katie from the Mac Core podcast. Not the Mac Core anymore, from the Mac Power Users.
Power Users.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
So she's one of the cool kids in the, you know, podcasting world. But anyway, she
should listen
just
to that show. It's actually a really, really good show. They do a great job. And she and David do a fantastic job there. So check that show out. Go ahead, John. Yeah,
we'll link to it. So anyways, she so this was a case where I had run into this before and exhibited a little Google foo. So she had tweeted something out saying, oh, no, my Apple LCD display, the power light is flashing three times. Like, oh, boy, because typically on most pieces of equipment, and I'm going to build in a rant here. So a lot of pieces of equipment, when something's wrong, you'll get either, like on a lot of Macs, you'll hear beeps or tones, and they'll typically be in a pattern, like, you know, short, long, or whatever. And I found this article where Apple Displays do something similar. So Apple Displays, and the title is Apple LCD Displays, Power Light Flashes. And this is where I started to get worried because there are three different patterns, and the problem can range anywhere from, I think the worst case is I've detected a problem with the backlight, which basically means you can probably toss it in that the backlight's failed, which makes the display not very useful. The middle of the road problem is the other pattern means you plugged in the wrong power adapter. What's wrong with you? I didn't think that was the case. Then the third one, unfortunately, this was this because she gave me the feedback and said that solved it. And this is a little finger wag at Apple. The pattern was short, short, short. And what Apple says in this article, that means the display is detecting wrong video format or an unsupported resolution. And their suggested resolution to this is not that resolution, but another resolution. The way to solve the problem is to reset the PRAM. She reset the PRAM or whatever machine it was. That solved the problem. Here's my rant. Why are you, you know, it's a display, Dave. You know what it could do? It could display the fact that the signal is out of sync.
No, John, it did display that fact. It showed the three blinking lights, right? That's perfect for a display. I mean, that's all we use our displays for anyway, right? It's just looking at the blinking lights.
I'm especially since Apple displays tend to command a premium. I'm surprised that, and I've run into this on, like, I have a Samsung. I've used Samsung and Dell screens. I think actually they're very similar. I think they source the tubes from the same place.
Yeah.
And I would personally recommend either one of those to hook up to a Mac, and I have done that. But on those displays, if a signal comes into it and the signal is not, you know, the wrong frequency or the wrong resolution, it'll say something like, you know, a signal out of range, I think, is what a lot of these will say, which basically means is either the frequency or the resolution that the device that's talking to me is trying to negotiate is one that I don't support. And it says it in English or, I guess, the language of your choice. So, anyways, this had a happy ending. I'm kind of surprised that the PRAM corruption caused the computer to request a wacky resolution. But it worked. And then I think I'll find another article, too, because, again, this is something that a lot of Macs will do, is that if they have an issue when they start up, they'll do beeps. I actually remember some Macs would do something cool, as they would make, a sound of a traffic accident, you know, like screeching tires and breaking glass.
Yeah.
But anyways.
Yeah. Yeah.
So wrapping that up, but beeps and blinking lights, usually you got to dig around and Apple's pretty good. If you got the Google foo, you can find out what it's trying to tell you.
Yeah, there you go. Cool. All right. Well, I think that wraps us up. I mean, almost wraps us up. We need to make sure everybody knows how to get in touch with us, John.
Why would you want it to be? I mean...
The phone number to call is 206-666-GEEK, which is...
As we all know, 4335. But that's not the only way to get in touch with us, Dave. You can also email us. And if I wanted to email us with either text or screenshots or movies or audio or whatever, I would send an email to feedback@macgeekgab.com, Dave.
Did you say feedback@macgeekgab.com, John?
That's what I said, and I'm sticking to it.
All right. So feedback@macgeekgab.com works. Premium@macgeekgab.com works. If you're a premium subscriber, and I'm going to take a quick minute here. We've had quite a few people that have said, gosh, you know, I just found out about the premium thing. If I'd known, I would have signed up sooner. So I want to make sure everybody knows, John and I, for the past almost 6 months now, have been doing an extra 2 episodes a month. We call those Mac Geek Gab Premium. And for $25 for 6 months, you can have access to those. It also gives you access to the archives. And we have a lot of fun with the premium show. It's more of what we're doing here. It's we're answering questions, solving your problems. And we do attempt to make sure that if we're answering a premium user's question, that we're doing it in the premium show, and the same with the rest. So if you're not a premium subscriber, you won't necessarily be excluded. Can't promise that happens 100% of the time, but we do attempt not to exclude anybody. And if we do, you know, you get an email from us anyway, so don't worry about it.
Mm-hmm. To lead into another way to, you know, keep up with what we're doing, so I want to point out is with the premium show is that, you know, I lovingly craft the show notes for both of the shows here, and right. You can see the show notes, which often contain answers to the
sure.
questions.
Of course.
Those are free. You can see those even if you're not a subscriber.
Right.
And if you want to find out when the show notes are posted, as long as when the show itself is posted, on Twitter, you can look at MacGeekGab. If you want to follow me and my ranting and raving about things that aren't necessarily Mac related, that's John F. Braun. If you want to follow Dave's rants,
yeah,
that would be Dave Hamilton. Pilot Pete is Pilot Pete, and the Mac Observer is Mac Observer. All very straightforward Twitter handles. So follow some of those if you like.
That's right. The We Have Communicators podcast is the one that Michael Johnston does when he's not converting the AAC for us. Cashfly, CacheFly.com provides all the bandwidth to get the podcast from us to you. The podcast marketplace includes the A2 desktop speakers from Audio Engine, Yojimbo, with a new update today from Barebones Software, PDF Pen and Disc Label from Smile on My Mac, Notebook from Circus Ponies, and GoTo Assist Express from Citrix at GoToAssist.com/Gab, all through the Backbeat Media Podcast Network.
That's it, I guess.
I hope. The Comcast guy hopes.
Yeah, he's probably getting paid anyways, right?
Look, I don't... It's not really... I don't really care. Have fun. Hopefully we'll do a show next week from WWDC, as long as bandwidth permits. But in any event, don't get caught.
Made up.